This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, dust off your binoculars for a preview of the birds you might spot during the upcoming fall migration. But first, this week, President Obama spoke at the Clean Energy Summit in Las Vegas. It is, in many ways, clean energy's time to shine, because in some places, new solar and wind deals are undercutting the price of electricity generated by natural gas. The president took note.
For decades, we've been told that it doesn't make economic sense to switch to renewable energy. Today, that's no longer true.
And as more and more people discover the price is right on renewables, they're slapping solar panels on their roofs. And if you're one of those people, give us a call, 844-724-8255, or tweet us at SciFry, because we're going to talk about solar panel installations. The result of the solar boom, some consumers are buying less energy from the power companies. And as you might imagine, some utilities are not too happy about this new development. More on that in a few minutes. But first, joining us to talk about the solar boom is David Roberts. He's a staff writer at Vox.com. He joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Welcome back, David.
Hi, Ira. Glad to be here.
Are we really seeing a revolution in rooftop solar now?
Yes, I think by any measure, the word revolution applies at this point, and it's exciting because I think we're just right on the very, very beginning of it. So it's going to be a really exciting few years. Just for perspective, the residential solar industry grew 76% in the last year in the U.S.
Wow. So what is driving this growth? Is it the economies of scale? Is it the falling price of solar?
Well, you see a lot of things come together. I mean, if you look at the graph of the growth of solar panels, right up until 2010, it's sort of this very modest rising line, and then it just starts to shoot upwards. So a couple of things happened. One is China started subsidizing the heck out of their solar panel manufacturing industry and scaling it up really sharply. So solar panels got really, really, really cheap really quickly. And this was in combination with a lot of supportive policies in the U.S. when Obama came in, and the stimulus bill and otherwise.
Mm-hmm. But it's still though, solar power, rooftop solar power is still a tiny, tiny dent in overall electricity.
That's right. Total solar power provides less than 1% of U.S. electricity still. But these are at this point exponential growth numbers. So it took well over a decade to double the amount of rooftop solar prior to this year, and it's expected to double again almost every year in the next few years. So we're going to see, it's going to start to make a real dent, I think, within the next 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm. Solar power means greener watts for the consumer, but fewer greenbacks for the power company. Can utility companies reinvent themselves for the 21st century and an era of more and more distributed power? My next guest should know. Gil Quiñones is a president and CEO of the New York Power Authority, the largest state-owned electric utility in the United States. He's here in our New York studios. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Gil, you see this revolution brewing with rooftop solar, home batteries, distributed generation. What's your reaction sitting at the head of a huge company that's in the business of selling energy?
Well, it's very exciting. In New York, the growth was 300% over the past 3 years. That's more than double the growth nationwide in terms of rooftop solar. So we're really excited. You know, under Governor Cuomo's leadership, he had allocated $1 billion over the next 10 years to really spur the growth of solar here in New York.
So you're not fearful this is going to put you out of business?
No, I think utilities are going to find a way to adapt. And what utilities must do is to find a way to integrate solar so that it also benefits the operation of their grids. And I think that's what's happening in New York under our Reforming the Energy Vision regulatory overhaul. That's basically what we're doing. We're trying to find a different way for utilities to be incented and compensated in this new world.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask both you, Dave and Gil, does that mean we have to redesign the grid as we know it to handle the various different loads and sources of the power that's going to be on?
Yes. You know, utilities will have to modernize their grid so that this grid that Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla
still
built,
around
the one-way flow grid will have to be bidirectional or even multidirectional, and utilities will have to adapt as distributed energy resources become more and more.
David, do you agree? Is that what your reporting is showing too?
Yes, and this is it's an interesting transition for the grid, and it's less about physical infrastructure at this point than intelligence and coordination, since all these what we used to call customers are now also producers. They produce energy, they store it, they can sell it when it's expensive or store it when it's cheap, and so it becomes a matter of information technology. It's a matter of keeping track of all these tiny little producers, you know, hundreds of thousands of them.
Utilities in Arizona want to charge new rooftop solar customers $21 a month to connect to the grid. It's a flat fee. And even if they generate all they need, is that sort of a fee how you imagine utilities are going to make money in the future?
Some utilities are starting to do that, which is basically increasing the fixed charge component of the bill. I don't think that's the only approach. I'm also the chair of the Electric Power Research Institute, and the EPRI is doing a lot of work in terms of really doing the proper cost-benefit framework and calculation for distributed energy resources, and I think that will inform policymakers and regulators on how to properly price and charge customers in terms of distributed energy resources.
Yeah. You're never going to get off the grid totally. You need some backup, right? I mean, you have to have backup on the grid.
That's correct. I believe the grid will exist, and in fact, the grid will be an enabler.
An enabler.
And will foster more and more distributed energy resources. And so I agree with you.
Dave, do you find it interesting to hear how, in favor a giant power utility is? And will other states be emulating this idea?
Well, I think they'll have no choice because, utilities all over the country are fighting to put these new fees on solar homeowners because they're sort of panicking, but they're failing all over the place. I mean, Obama was just speaking in Nevada. Nevada, just Wednesday, the Public Utility Commission in Nevada ruled against the utilities, said you can't raise these fixed fees. The same thing happened in Colorado, actually, on Wednesday. So there's been something like 20-something states where utilities are trying to add these fees, and they're losing everywhere. The only place they've won even a modest victory is in Arizona. So I really think that changing the model, the utility model, the regulatory model, is the only way forward for utilities.
Gildy, we were talking about solar, but is there a mix of other green energies that go into this?
Absolutely. In New York, we're looking at energy efficiency. We're looking at demand response, meaning customers being able to react to price signals. We're looking at wind storage. So there are a multitude types of distributed energy resources that can be integrated into our power grid.
Mm-hmm. You've said that utility companies should transform themselves into distribution service platforms. In plain English, what is that? Can you give us an example? I understand there's an example in Brownsville section of Brooklyn.
Yeah. So in Brooklyn, which is growing tremendously, Con Ed was planning to build a new substation to serve the new needs in that area. And Con Edison, working with the Public Service Commission here in New York, said, well, let's try a different approach. Go to your customers and encourage them and work with them to put in distributed energy resources, energy efficiency, demand response, storage, solar, to defer and maybe even eliminate the need for investment in substation in the area.
Mm-hmm. And they responded to that?
Absolutely. They're in the middle of it. And that's the new paradigm on how this distributed energy resources can actually help utilities in the planning and in the operation of their grids.
Because if you're going to build a big power plant, you're working backwards, right? You're looking backwards instead of just building a distributed one. That's the old model. It's working. And you're encouraging them to look forward, and they're responding to it.
Absolutely. And I think the key is the big grid is still going to be there. But to design it so that the distributed energy resources will work in synchronicity with an evolving big grid is really the optimum way to serve the public.
So is your message to utilities, I mean, I'm gonna pull it crudely, adapt or die?
Well, you know, control your destiny, otherwise somebody else will.
Dave, what do you think of that?
It's worth noting that this is, unlike so many issues in U.S. politics these days, this is entirely, the public loves distributed solar energy, loves it across parties, across demographics, across regions. There is absolute political unanimity on this. So utilities who have gotten very accustomed to sort of going to their state regulators and legislators and massaging them for favors are just absolutely on the wrong side of history on this, and they're just going to get bulldozed if they don't adapt quickly.
You know, I'm seeing this in Iowa in the caucuses that the Republicans are there. Years ago, they would never talk about subsidies, wind power subsidies, but wind is so big in Iowa now that even conservative Republicans are saying, oh, yeah, this is a good thing. The wind is great for this state.
One of the most interesting things going on recently is in Georgia. You know, the utility in Georgia was down on rooftop solar power, and this group of Tea Party activists got together. They're calling themselves Green Tea on behalf of distributed rooftop solar because it's absolutely in line with their values. It gives them more independence from these state-sponsored monopolies. So this is there's nowhere to hide on this politically.
Last comment quickly?
Yeah, but I think you will see more and more that utilities are actually going to embrace and adopt this because of what that trend is clear. And here in New York, I got to give credit to all the investor-owned utilities here and the public utilities here in New York. They have embraced this change, evolving with this change, right, and looking forward to it.
Great talking with you, Gil Quiñones, President and CEO of the New York Power Authority. Dave Roberts, a staff writer at Vox.com. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks,
we're going to take
Ira.
A break. We're going to
Thank
put
you,
science
Ira.
To a test, a look at the problem of reproducing results in scientific research. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. One of the big science stories this year was actually a retracted paper. You might remember the study that said gay and lesbian canvassers could influence voters just by talking to them face to face. Might be true. Might not. We don't know, because it turns out the researchers made up the data, and the fabrication was only found out when other researchers tried to reproduce the study and failed. A team of researchers decide to put science to the test and just see how many studies could be replicated. That's what they did. Well, if this the kind of paper is a failure, how many other papers are like that? They looked at lots of psychological studies, and their success rate was not so good. They were only able to reproduce the original results half the time. The failures in those studies were due to fraud, but they weren't due to fraud, but to what scientists have been calling the reproducibility problem. Never heard of that, the reproducibility problem. Is this a sign of a breakdown in science, or is this part of the process? That's what we're going to be talking about. If you'd like to join our discussion, 844-SCI-TALK, 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my guest. Brian Nosek is executive director at the Center for Open Science, the group that conducted this replication study. He's also professor of psychology at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome, Dr. Nosek.
Thanks for having me on.
We've always heard that replicating results is one of the, you know, the fundamentals of validating research, but it looks like that's easier said than done. How did your group replicate these studies?
Well, what we did was we defined a sample of studies from three journals in our field that are important journals, and then we reached out to the original authors, asked them for their materials so that we could do as good a job as we could reproducing how it is they did the research. We drafted protocols for each of those replications and then sent those to the original authors for feedback and for others independently to give feedback. Then we pre-registered those designs and analysis plans on the Open Science framework so that others could scrutinize what we were doing while we did it. And then we conducted the studies, a number of different independent groups, 270 co-authors in all.
Why is it so difficult to reproduce what was originally done?
Well, there's a few reasons that reproducibility may be low. One of them is that science is hard. We are investigating questions and topics where we are at the boundaries of knowledge and we don't have a clear sense of when things will and will not occur. And so it's hard to get those results multiple times while we're still investigating, exploring, discovering things about the phenomenon.
Did you want to continue?
Well, there's another way to frame it, which is there are three different possibilities to understand why original studies got a result and the replication studies didn't get the same result. One is that the original result was false in some way, right? It was a false positive. It detected an effect that wasn't really there. A second possibility is that it was the replication is a false negative. It failed to detect that original effect, even though it's there, just via chance. But the third possibility is the real interesting one, which is both of them are correct in some way, but they differ in some fundamental parts, a different sample, a different setting, a different nuances in the procedures that cause the difference between the original and the replication. But the challenge in science is trying to figure out, hypothesize what that might be. What are the differences that might explain why these differed? And then do new studies to try to accumulate more evidence for those explanations.
Can you give us an example of a study that didn't replicate? What didn't match up in the original versus the replicated study?
Well, there are a number of studies. I'll give an example of my own. I had one of the studies that was in the pool to be replicated. And what we had done in the original research was find that people would learn about one person, learn that they've done some bad things, and then they would learn that there is a new person in a different group, in the same group, but they don't know anything about that second person. And when you ask people, how do you feel about the second person, they say, well, I don't know. I don't know anything about that person. They don't use the information about person A to generalize about person B because that would be stereotyping. But implicitly, they do that. They transfer the information they learned about person A to person B because they're in the same group. And we found that that occurred, and then it generalized to our conscious feelings after a few days when you forget who it was that did what. Well, the replication tried to reproduce that finding, and it reproduced parts of it, but the key test that was the target for replication didn't show the same result.
And do you have any explanation for that?
Well, right now we don't, other than it's possible that both of them or the average between the two is the more correct answer between them. So this is really one of the key pieces of insight, and although it's not a new insight, from the results of this research, which is no study is definitive. That first study provided some evidence about the phenomenon. The replication provides additional evidence. And in aggregate, they provide even more evidence. And so really, science as a process is a process of uncertainty reduction. Our models of how the world works are incomplete. We are wrong about everything in some fundamental way. And so what science does to make progress is to figure out where we're wrong and become less wrong over time. Mm-hmm. And so that accumulation of evidence across many studies is really where we arrive at a conclusion, rather than thinking that the first time we investigate something, we've discovered the conclusion straight off.
Do you think that the results of these studies is true for all the sciences, not just psychology, but chemistry, physics, whatever?
Yeah, it's a good question. And in one way, we don't know, because this is the first study that's done a reproducibility effort in a systematic way like this, although there's lots of hints that there are reproducibility challenges across the sciences. And the reason for that is that the incentives for success in science are not necessarily aligned with maximizing or improving reproducibility. So how I succeed and the members of my lab succeed in science is publication. And so we have to produce results that maximize the likelihood of publishing, being able to publish those results and to publish them in prestigious outlets if we can. But not everything gets published. You're more likely to get a result published if it's a positive result that shows a relationship rather than no relationship. You're more likely to publish if it's a novel result, something that people hadn't thought about before or hadn't observed before. And you're more likely to get published if it's a clean story, that you can put all of the pieces together and show that you have a clear understanding of that phenomenon.
Is there some hesitance for journals to publish reproduced studies? I mean, are they looking for original work, even if this one doesn't work?
Yeah, and that has both human and competitive tendencies behind that, right? The competitive mm-hmm. tendency is journals want to survive and thrive as well. And so novel, positive, clean results are better results. It is great when we get those. The challenge is that we very rarely get those. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because we're studying stuff we don't understand. It is a mess. We are trying to put things together. We have a difficult time explaining what it is we're investigating. That's why we're studying it. We don't study things that we know well because what's the point? And so the mess that's in the sort of the lab of what we're trying to do and how we're trying to figure out isn't incentivized when we're putting it out into a report. And so that can create reproducibility challenges. The published literature may be more beautiful than reality.
Do you think that your follow-up study here, your published study, gives a black eye to science?
I hope it doesn't. It certainly presents a challenge, and that is that the rate of reproducibility we observed in this study is probably lower than many would expect, or at least many would hope for, that we presume when we see published literature that we know inside that some of it isn't going to reproduce easily, but we mm-hmm. presume that probably more of it does. But the positive of this is that it was a self-study, right? This were a group of psychologists got together, volunteered their time to contribute to trying to investigate their own discipline to identify challenges for reproducibility. And then once we have now some empirical evidence, that gives some basis for the initiatives to try to improve reproducibility. Mm-hmm. And psychology has been one of those fields that's both been looking at itself self-critically and also pursuing a lot of innovative progressive initiatives to try to increase reproducibility in the research that it publishes.
I want to bring on another guest to talk about the impact of all of this irreproducibility. Leonard Friedman is president of the Global Biological Standards Institute based in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. I'm a very big fan of the show. I've been listening to it for years.
Oh, thank you. Your study looked at preclinical research. You put a price on all this irreproducible research at $28 billion. Tell us how you arrived at that figure and what was involved in preclinical research.
Yeah, so I know it's an eye-popping number. And we wanted to calculate really the economic costs of exactly what Brian Nosek has been discussing, albeit we focused on preclinical, that is basic research in the biomedical arena, where I think there are lots of parallels to what Brian has described in the social sciences. And to do that, we teamed up with two Boston University economists. I'm not an economist myself. I'm a molecular biologist. Tim Simcoe and Ian Cockburn. And these guys actually had studied for several years the impact of standards and best practices in different industries, such as electronics, shipping, telecommunications. There really is no very good set of studies certainly in biomedical research along the same lines. So we had to do sort of a bottom-up analysis and a top-down analysis to come up with this number. I don't really want to get into the gory mm-hmm. details here, but in the bottom-up analysis, we identified four major categories that we think are major contributors to irreproducibility, at least in biomedical research. And they are study design, biological reagents and reference materials, lab protocols, and data analysis and reporting. Some of these overlap, I think, very well with the social sciences. Some of them, like reagents and reference materials, don't. We estimated flaws and errors in each of those areas and came up with prevalence values. And there are limitations to this study with, you know, a low end, a high end, and a midpoint. The midpoint was 53%, which is actually quite close to Brian's recently, like yesterday, published 60% irreproducibility rate.
And how much of this is, if I was listening to the factors, it sounds a lot like a lot of it is human error in either reading the data, analyzing the data.
That's right. That's right. And so we think that there are opportunities here, you know, like you were discussing with Brian Nosek. There is a sort of negativity to these kinds of numbers, $28 billion that have been spent on irreproducible research is a pretty sobering kind of message. But we also think that there are opportunities here where we can identify areas where there can be substantial improvement.
So are we talking about sloppy science, just sloppy data collection and analysis? Because that's what it sounds like.
It does sound like that, but it isn't quite that, because researchers can be doing exemplary work and nonetheless end up with an irreproducible result. And that's primarily because of uncertainty, of having to make inferences from incomplete information. Sorry, Len, to interrupt. I'm sure you have other thoughts on that, too.
No, I mean, I agree with that. But I also think that there are opportunities in terms of, again, in the biomedical realm, there are issues with the application of poor reagents, for example. There's a whole controversy around misidentified cell lines that cell biologists and molecular biologists use, even though there are straightforward assays where one can identify or authenticate those cell lines. There are issues with reagents such as research antibodies, which are very, very poorly characterized. And anybody who's worked in a lab can tell you they've had that experience where they think they're using an antibody that will give them a quality result, and it doesn't. So I think that, although, as Brian was saying, there's also a very profound cultural component to this, including the kinds of perverse incentives that Brian was alluding to. Mm-hmm. I think that there are opportunities where modest investments. So when we say $28 billion is applied to irreproducible research, we're not advocating that that amount should be, for example, cut from the research budget. We're actually advocating that with modest investments, we can correct some of these flaws, not all of them, and get tremendous returns on investment.
I've got to remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about irreproducible events. It's in a comedy magazine, it's a science magazine, I think. Also has that as its sort of like its title. Let me go to the phones. Our phone number is 844-724-8255. Let's go to Duncan in Rochester, New York. Hi, Duncan.
How are you?
Hey there.
I'd like to give another example of where reproducible results occur within your own organization. About 20 years ago, I make an optical material in glass, and we were transitioning it to production. And we started producing it in January, we had no problems with production until all of a sudden, using the same processes, in July, it didn't work. It took us about 3 months to figure out what's going on. It turns out it was the humidity change in Rochester. Another example occurred to us about a year ago when we were doing some stuff in polymer work, and the supplier of one of our polymers changed one of the components in the polymer without telling us. And suddenly a process that had been very stable was completely unstable. And so sometimes, even with your own research group, you can have irreproducible results.
That's interesting. All right. Thanks for calling. That's quite interesting. Brian, how are our journals beginning to address this problem?
There's a number of new initiatives that journals are pursuing. One of them is called the TOP Guidelines, Transparency and Openness Promotion. And there are more than 500 journals that have added themselves as signatories to this, which means that they're going to investigate adoption of a number of different standards, data transparency, methods and materials transparency, a lot of the things like Len was describing, making sure it's clear which reagents were used, whether validation was done on those reagents or antibodies, and then also pre-registration of research designs and incentives for replication. Another thing that a number of journals are trying is called registered reports, and there are 16 journals that are doing this now, where peer review is done prior to knowing the results of the study. In most research now, we do the studies in our lab, we write up the report, and we submit it. And all the incentives are driving towards making those results as beautiful as possible to get through peer review when it's submitted to the journal. But with doing peer review in advance of knowing the results, the incentives are for making sure that your question is the most important and best framed question possible, and that your methodology is the strongest possible to test that question.
All right.
And that's the basis of publication.
All right. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank my guests, Brian Nosek, Executive Director at the Center for Open Science, Professor of Psychology, University of Virginia, Charlottesville, Leonard Friedman, President of the Global Biological Standards Institute based in Washington. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about migrating birds. So get ready to talk about what birds you might see in your backyard after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 5 billion, with a B, 5 billion songbirds call North America home. And I'm guessing more than a few of them live right in your backyard. Can you guess this common backyard bird? Ah, so peaceful. Yeah. Do you know what that bird is? Give us a tweet. Get it? At SciFri, SCIFRI, if you can identify it. Well, out of those 5 billion birds, over half of them don't have a year-round home. They drift north and south with the seasons. And as things get a little chillier up north, they head south past us. Sort of looking at it differently, we all live in flyover territory for the birds. Spotted the new flock in town, wondering where those birds in your feeder may be headed? Give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. Tweet us a picture of a species. Yeah, tweet us something. A bird at SciFri you've been seeing around lately. Emma Gregg is a project leader of Project Feeder Watch at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. Welcome back to Science Friday, Emma.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What are you seeing up in your neck of the woods these days?
Well, I was thinking about this now that it's the migration time. What have I been seeing? Because I thought you might ask. And I have to say that what I've noticed most in the past couple of weeks as I've walked into the office is actually a lack of songs. So it hasn't been so much the migrants passing through that have caught my attention, but the end of all the Baltimore Orioles and yellow warblers singing their songs during the breeding season.
What does that mean to you?
It means that fall is here, or fall is on its way, and winter is coming.
Mm-hmm. So what might we see once that migration? What are the signs we should look for?
Well, so there are several things that start to happen. And I think what's most familiar to people during the migration time is that there is an influx of new species that pass through. There are species that have been here all summer that leave. And then there are some species that live in more northern locations, such as tree sparrows and snow buntings, that will show up. So there's a change in the species composition that'll come to your backyards. But there are some other things that happen as well, including in birds that don't migrate, a change in their behaviors. Hmm. And I can tell you
like
a little
what?
Bit about that.
Yeah.
Well, one really conspicuous thing that happens to blackbirds in the autumn season is they start going from being in territories where they're raising young and building nests, and they begin congregating in really large flocks, which they'll stay in throughout the winter. And this becomes really conspicuous because huge, huge flocks of thousands of blackbirds, often composed of multiple species, red-winged blackbirds, grackles, cowbirds, will visit people's feeders, and they'll do so all at once. And it can be quite overwhelming to have that many individuals coming to eat your cracked corn and black oil sunflower seed.
It's a flash mob. Flash mob at your feeder.
Definitely. Flash mob of blackbirds at feeders. So, and those birds aren't necessarily migrating. So it's a change in behavior that happens at this time of year.
Let's talk about your project, Feeder Watch. Do you have any tips for making feeders and yards more attractive to our feathered friends? And, you know, speaking about that, you always hear people say, you don't want to feed the birds at the winter. You want them to fly south. What's your take on all of that?
That is a question that we get moderately often to our feeder watch inboxes, our emails. So people are thinking that and wondering it. And let me bust that myth right now. Keeping bird feeders out will not prevent birds from migrating. Hmm. There are many internal and external cues that birds are using to tell them when to migrate. And having a little snack is the last thing that's going to keep them from doing it. And I like to use the analogy of running in a marathon. If you were about to run a marathon, you wouldn't wait until you were really hungry to start.
Mm-mm.
So not having food is not the cue that birds are going to use to start migrating. Mm. So if anything, a little feeder, a little seed, a little nectar will help them on their journey. Mm.
Let's see someone who's trying to help his birds out. Sean in Fairbanks. Hi, Sean. Have you seen any different birds?
Yes, I have, Ira. Lots of birds passing through heading south.
Wow. What can you recognize what they are?
Absolutely, I can. Yeah. For instance, we have a large number of sandhill cranes heading south right now, and you can hear them pretty much every morning at around 6 a.m. Squawking as they fly overhead.
Wow. Well, Emma, what do you think of that?
I think that's fantastic. Sandhill cranes are a really wonderful species to see during the migration because there are lots of places in North America where they won't occur except during migration. So they'll breed in the north, they'll winter in the south. And so lots of us in the middle part of the continent only get to enjoy them as they're passing over. And those squawks that the caller was mentioning are sometimes the best cue that they're around. They'll fly so high that they're often really hard to see. But the calls are very conspicuous, these bugling, cackling calls. And when you hear that, if you know it, you know, sandhill cranes, it must be the time of year for migration.
Well, every year I talk about my great frustration in attracting hummingbirds to my backyard. I've planted trumpet vines, all kinds of showy plants. Not one yet. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. Maybe I should do the bird feeder route.
Flowers, feeders. A little bath water. Hummingbirds will come and drink bath water, or you can put out a mister.
They migrate.
You're doing everything right.
And they have they make a huge migration, don't they?
They sure do. Yes, hummingbirds can fly. Despite the fact that they're so delicate and they need to eat so frequently, they can really take on some serious feats of endurance during migration. Hmm. And I think one of the most noteworthy are ruby-throated hummingbirds, which are one of the more widespread species in North America, which will fly all the way across the Gulf of Mexico in one shot, even though they're so tiny and there are no flowers on the way. So they have to do it all at once.
Let me go to Phoenix, Arizona. Let's check in with Ethan. Hi, Ethan. Welcome to Science Friday. Ethan, are you there? I sort of heard his little reflection there. He was asking actually a question I was going to ask also, and that is climate change affecting the migration at all?
Yeah, well, so that is one of the hardest questions. It's a good question to ask, and it's a hard question to answer because climate change is affecting not only bird populations, but plant populations and plant phenology, the invertebrates that live on those plants, and therefore the birds that feed on those plants and insects. And so the short answer is absolutely yes, but exactly how it's impacting both migratory and resident species is really complex. And to at least provide a little bit of detail, the one thing that I can say that biologists who are studying this have been observing is in some species, although not all, they're noticing an advance in arrival dates in spring. So as winters are becoming more mild, the locations are becoming warmer, birds are in some cases showing up to their breeding grounds earlier.
Wow.
And whether or not that's actually good for them depends on a lot of other factors. So it's a really complicated puzzle to solve. And I think the take-home message for listeners is that this is a really important time to be watching the birds that are coming to your backyard, and it's a great time to be participating in bird counting efforts such as the Christmas Bird Count or eBird or Project Feeder Watch, because lots of things are happening now because the climates are changing.
Quick call to Joe in Sleepy Hollow. I'm jealous of Joe.
talk to you. I was listening to your comments here, and I was just sitting on my deck listening to it, and pretty much throughout here there's been a nonstop parade of hummingbirds to our two feeders out here. And I'm also noticing that it seems to be not just be males. It seems to be the females are coming, too, now.
All right. I'm heading to your house, Joe. Thanks. Thanks.
Yeah, that
send
sounds
him,
good.
Send him our way down here. Thanks a lot. I want to thank you, Emma, for taking time to be with us today. And good luck on good luck on your Project Feeder Watch. Emma Gregg, who is project leader of Project Feeder Watch at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. For the rest of the hour, you're advised to tightly affix those thinking caps. Earlier this week, physicist Stephen Hawking gave a lecture about one of his specialties, black holes. In a talk at KTH Royal Institute of Technology in Sweden, he tackled the question, is the information that goes into a black hole actually destroyed? Here's a bit of what he said.
I propose that the information is stored, not in the interior of the black hole as one might expect, but on its boundary, the event horizon, in the form of super translations of the horizon. This is a form of holography, recording the state of a four-dimensional region on its boundary, the horizon.
If that left you scratching your head, like it did us, Sean Carroll is here to help translate. Sean is a theoretical physicist at Caltech, author of the book The Particle at the End of the Universe. Welcome back, Sean.
Thank you, Ira.
What was he talking about? What was the problem? What was he trying to solve?
He was declaring a solution to a problem that he himself invented back in the 1970s when Stephen Hawking taught us that black holes are not completely black. They give off radiation. And therefore, if you throw something into a black hole, if you drop a planet in or a book for that matter, eventually all the information that went in the form of that book or that planet or whatever should come out in that radiation, but no one knows how that could happen.
And so he's explaining how it could happen?
He is telling us that he can explain how it happened. It was a little bit, you know, not quite enough information there to actually see the details of what he is proposing, or his collaborators also are proposing. There's no paper out yet, so we're kind of left to fill in the gaps for ourselves for the moment.
What kind of, what is he talking about, the hologram? He mentioned a hologram on the edge of the black hole.
Well, this is one of the intriguing things. Something called the holographic principle has been around since the 1990s, based on what we're trying to do to understand where the information is in black holes. And a lot of people think, for a long time now, that there's some sense in which the information falls inside the black hole, but there's also another sense in which the information is encoded in a two-dimensional kind of hologram on the surface of the black hole rather than inside.
Hmm. I'm talking with Sean Carroll about black holes on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Why is this such an important thing to know, to figure this out?
Well, I think that you could very easily make the case that the single biggest puzzle or question in the fundamental physics that we have, the very basic of what the universe does, basic nature of the universe, is reconciling quantum mechanics with gravity, with Einstein's general relativity. We just don't know how to make a good theory of quantum gravity. And we have almost no data. We can't build an accelerator that helps us because gravity is so weak. What we can do is to propose thought experiments and try to carry them through and see what could possibly be going on. So the information coming out of black holes is the single best thought experiment that we've so far thought of to try to help us understand quantum gravity.
Is there any way to test his idea, something that we could look for near a black hole to say whether Hawking is on the right track?
No.
Drive safely.
Tip your waitresses, yes. We're not there yet, but that's too bad. We would love to be able to do it. We don't think that any of the black holes that we know about existing in our galaxy are emitting radiation, but it's far too faint for us ever to see. It's much fainter, much colder even than the microwave background radiation. So there's no practical hope of going and measuring it. So that's why right now we're just trying to get the logic right. If we had two really promising theories for how the information escaped from black holes, then we would be really interested in observationally distinguishing between them. But mm-hmm. since right now we have zero, that's less of a pressing issue.
It's sort of described as like, he sort of, I think, talked about it, storing the information like burning a book. You still have the information, but it's sort of not readable easily.
That's exactly right. You know, no one is thinking that you'll easily just look at the black hole and see what got thrown in. This is a matter of principle. If you were infinitely good at collecting the information and infinitely good at reconstructing it, could you do it? And what Hawking is basically saying is that we used to think that the surface of a black hole was perfectly smooth and featureless. There was no trace of what went inside. And he's actually saying that maybe there's some kind of quantum mechanical splotchiness that gets stuck to the edge, to the event horizon of the black hole, from which we can, in principle, read off what made it.
Mm-hmm. Is the fact that he's talking about such an esoteric idea, is that what's making it newsworthy? If someone else, yeah?
I mean, it is newsworthy because this is awesome stuff that everyone should be thinking about every day. But the fact that this particular talk that he gave is getting a lot of attention, it's a little premature because we just haven't seen the paper. To a lot of people, what he seems to be claiming is almost too good to be true. Like, if that were the answer, we would be kind of saying, you know, wow, that's a lot simpler and sort of less subtle than we thought the answer would turn out to be.
Hmm. So we'll have to wait to see the paper.
I think that's a good idea, yeah.
Yeah, I get it thrown on your doorstep like mine, I'm sure. All right, John, as always, thank you. You have such great lucid explanations for these things, and we appreciate it.
It's a fun universe to talk about.
It certainly is. Sean Carroll, theoretical physicist at Caltech and author of the book The Particle at the End of the Universe. You can begin to understand a little bit about it by reading his books. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And we have a bonus podcast this week. Yeah, conversation with Tracy Kidder, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Soul of a New Machine. We interviewed Tracy over at Google Hangout. And that whole interview, discussion with the audience, is available for you to listen to as a podcast up on our website. Check it out. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.